Everybody, Patrick Connor, and welcome back to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. Man, we're all about boxing history here, which means I am here with my dude Aris Pina, combi box operator and fight history fanatic for our purposes today. Aris, how's it going, man?
It's going good, bro. You know, looking forward to the weekend. We got the Boxing Hall of Fame coming up. A few other things happening, but we're here to talk some history, so I'm hyped about it. Let's do this.
We're always like, yeah, I mean, we're pretty nerdy about this shit. Nerdy enough that talking history, talking fight history is like, you know, this is what we do for fun. This is how we get our jollies out. So we're sick. We acknowledge we're sick. But look, dude, you know, the recent events, as far as some recent fights, I think probably the main fight that happened recently, Naoya Inoue versus Nonito Donaire specifically, had us thinking about what rematches are like when it comes to big fights and fights of the year and stuff like that. Yeah. And I mean, just in general,
do they live up or not, right?
Yeah. I mean, they often don't live up to the first fight or the big fight, whichever the case may be. And we were talking about that the other day and thought about that this would be a great topic for a history show, dude.
Totally. I mean, it's, look, man, when you have a major fight, like a fight of the year candidate or just like big fights, whatever it may be, because of a controversial ending, there always has to be a rematch. And usually with a major, major fight of the year, it's really hard to surpass the greatness of a first fight. So like if a trilogy, for example, there's always like a great first fight, kind of a slump in the second one. And then the third one, they like take it back. And maybe it's not as great as the first one, but they bring it almost to that extent. You know what I mean? But yeah, there's in boxing, it's history, dude. The boxing world goes back God knows how long. And there's been a lot of memorable rematches, a lot of memorable trilogies, a lot of things, whether they've lived up or not. And that's what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, it's literally, this could be like a 9-hour show, but we're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that. We're condensing a little bit. Just some of our favorites.
It's going to be a 12-hour show. No, I'm just kidding. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to condense it as much as we can. But like, so let's kick it off with something good. What would you say is like a big fight or fight of the year type of thing where...
Okay, here's one that's really crazy, right? Because it wasn't the fight of the year, but it ended up being the fight of the decade, according to Ring Magazine. And that's wild to me. But, you know, I could picture Randy Gordon and Burt Sugar and probably Johnny Boss and a few other people in the Ring Magazine office flipping a coin, like flipping a quarter while drinking, you know, Wild Turkey or some shit. Well, like flipping a quarter to figure out what would be the fight of the year. And that was between Bazooka Limon and Bobby Chacon, which I'm not talking about, and Aaron Pryor, Alexis Arguello.
Man. Yeah.
See, that's what I mean to segue into the rematch.
Totally understandable. I mean, to have to choose.
Dude, to choose between those two, I can totally, I would have to flip a quarter. Like, Limon Chacon 4 is probably my favorite fight ever. Like, or close to it.
If you're talking just straight action,
yeah,
like just pure action and not necessarily like not factoring in like greatness or any of that type of stuff, it's one of the top few fights ever, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. No question.
Totally. I mean, just especially if you know the backstory, everything going from the history, the way they fought, and then that last round when Chacon finally drops him. I mean, it's, you know, it's the chef's kiss. Academy Award winner, best pitcher by far. But that's a whole podcast on its own that I'm sure we'll talk about one day. Prior Arguello, that same year, dude, we've talked about this fight before. You know what I mean? Alexis Arguello chasing greatness, trying to become a 4-division world champion, everything going on. Aaron Pryor, the maniac rampaging the junior welterweight, who's always felt that everyone has been against him ever since the 76 Olympic trials when he lost to Howard Davis. And he's been scrapping since then. He's been looking for respect. He's been looking for that mega fight. He hasn't been able to secure it. Arguello wants to challenge him. They're in Miami, like during the height of like the cocaine era, like everything just hits at once, dude. They produced one of the best fights you could have ever seen, man. Like HBO had a legendary night spider, but they just back and forth. Pryor in his windmill style, Arguello in his precision, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. that right hand Arguello hit him with that would have knocked out a fucking heavyweight. That Pryor's head snapped back into the, you know, the lights. And Pryor comes back. You know, the controversy after it that we've discussed before with the black bottle and all these other things, yada, yada, yada. They had to have a rematch, right? So let me ask you this. Did it live it up to it?
I mean, it wasn't a bad fight. It just...
No, it wasn't. But, like...
It can't live
it,
up
it to took it. It took a while. Like, after that fight, there was a controversy that we talked about with the black bottle. You know, if you listen to the show, you clearly know what we're talking about. Pryor had a lot of out-of-the-ring issues going on at this point now. Like, you know, the internet age obviously wasn't there, so we weren't privy to everything that he was doing, but there was rumors that Pryor was definitely, you know, a man of the night, and there was a lot of stuff going on with him. We just weren't know we at this point, no one knew the extent of how bad it was, right? But Arguello, too, well, you know, we didn't really know how much of a spent bullet he was, and he kind of was, you know. The Pryor fight was kind of his apex right there. You know what we talked about before on prior shows, when you reach your ceiling, he kind of reached it with Pryor. And, you know, whether Pryor used, you know, added enhancements in that black bottle or whatever it was is, you know, up to debate. But Arguello had reached that ceiling. So when they had the rematch, obviously, you know, that even with all of the out of the ring issues, Pryor just kind of dominated.
Yeah, dude, Alexis Arguello had gone from featherweight and was a very good featherweight to, you know, an even better fighter at 130 pounds and wasn't at lightweight quite long enough to make a mark like he did at 130, in my opinion. But then moving to 140, it was like, all right, you know, we've talked about this in other shows and how a fighter's frame might be able to carry them up weight divisions a little bit better. And it seemed as though a guy, you know, El Flaco Explosivo, the explosive thin man, he had that frame. He had a very wide, so thin tall frame, like almost like a Tommy Hearns like frame, where Tommy Hearns went from, he was 135 pounds as an amateur and finished at cruiserweight. And I'm not saying he should have been at cruiserweight, but he actually looked okay at cruiserweight because how fucking big he was. But that point being that Alexis Arguello kind of had that kind of frame where it was believable he could go up to 140 pounds. And he shook Aaron Pryor with a couple shots where, again, made it believable that he could do okay at 140 pounds. And yeah, the controversy sucks. I guess it is up for debate whether or not there was something in the bottle, but it seems pretty obvious that there was. Either way, it was an epic fight. And then in order to get back to that rematch, you know, how could you live up to that first fight? You just can't in terms of action. I mean, it's almost impossible to. And at that point, like you said, Alexis Arguello had already, he had it beaten out of him in the first fight. He gave everything he had in that fight. And then in the second fight, you could see, like, in even just the way the fight ended, and Arguello did that kind of thing, like almost slightly more pathetic than Zaragoza against Morales, but, like, you know, almost that kind of acknowledgement where he's just like, dude,
sad. He just really sat anything. There on his hands.
He just sat there nodding as he's counted out, like, yeah, that's it. I don't have anything else.
And here's the thing, man. Not only did Pryor not have any, you know, controversy going into that, like, I mean, like, in terms of his cornerman with Panama Lewis, who we should probably do a true crime story on that, don't you think?
We should probably just do a Panama Lewis one and talk about the Costello and fucking
everything else he did. Yeah, we probably should do a Panama Lewis one. Let's put that in our notes one day.
Icky fellow. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very icky. But that's the type of people boxing attracts sometimes. Anyways, for the rematch, Pryor enlisted Emmanuel Stewart from the Kronk Champ, you know, legendary Emmanuel Stewart, who at this point, you know, had made his bones with Tommy Hearns and Hilmer Kenty and a few others at this point, you know, but never, you know, he hadn't reached the, you know, the elite legendary status that he would later on in his career. And Pryor at this point had a bunch of out of the ring issues. The amount of sparring that he did had left him with chronic migraines. He had a lot of stuff going on in terms of drugs and, you know, scuffles and stuff going on. But somehow he put on dominant performance and was able to stop him. Not to say that Arguello didn't have his moments. Like, Arguello still was competitive in the fight, but Pryor was just, you know, the rampaging guy that he was. Dude, and Not only that, man, like people, younger fans especially, when they talk about Pryor, they think of a guy that was just a whirlwind who just like overwhelmed you. If you really watch him, you know, I was watching Pryor at Grade 1 yesterday, last night, because I couldn't sleep. And the way he fought, bro, like some, you know, he had levels to him. You know what I mean? Like, watch the Cervantes fight, for instance. Antonio Cervantes, one of the greatest junior welterweight champions ever. Pryor comes out round one at like a windmill, just trying to overwhelm him as best he can. Cervantes is trying to counter off ropes. Cervantes caught him with a clean right hand, shot Pryor for a quick instant to his knee. Round two, Pryor comes out and just starts this quick twitching boxing style that's so hard to read. But he's not like really overwhelming you, but he's still putting pressure on you, but he's boxing you instead. And his footwork is immaculate. You can't really read him on what he's doing. And it's so like that type of Pryor would be a nightmare against anybody in history. Like he was beautiful to watch at that point. It's not really like
just a swarming attack. You're right.
No, man. He has so many layers to him. And that's what's made. And he did the same against Arguello. You know, like when he would come out there and the way he would bounce off his feet, jab, 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 and his head moving. And he would like, you know, his foot, like Jersey Joe Walcott type, like footwork that he would be doing and the other stuff. And then punching with his lead hand, throwing up, like you couldn't read him, you know, dude, Pryor was something. If he didn't really touch the drugs and didn't really do stuff like that, which is impossible considering the way he grew up, his environment, like everything that he had to come through from his background, he had a really, really tough background to come through. And considering the 80s, a guy like him who struggled to get to the top, and you can almost compare him slightly to Leon Spinks, I guess, and Tim, like getting everything at once and having coming from nothing and getting everything and just indulging in it. It's tough not to do. You know, he became a product of that. And it's unfortunate because look at his career. He still became a first ballot Hall of Famer and everything after everything he got through. And what he didn't really like, I still feel like he had so much more to accomplish than what he did. And he accomplished so much, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude, it feels like his career, he didn't have a super long career in terms of the amount of fights.
Yeah.
And in terms of the amount of years, although he had some layoffs here and there, obviously, but it feels like we could have gotten more out of him.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
But
like he should have been there against like guys like Chavez or Camacho. He still would have been there. He would have been a little bit older, but if he had never got into vices and other things outside of the ring issues, that could have happened. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of like, you know, that's that conundrum when it comes to boxing is, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of people likely to get into it are obviously the kind of people who are going to have a real tough time getting out of it intact. So
totally.
That's that kind of.
I miss Pryor though too, man, to say that at the least. He was just one of the genuinely nicest, coolest guys you could have meet.
Well, and you're talking about the Hall of Fame week coming up, you know, he would have been a popular.
Yeah, it sucks to say that because Aaron Pryor, when I my early years up until the mid 2000s, he would have been there. He was there every year, literally every year, very accessible. A friend of mine, a fellow CompuBox counter named Ben Chan, gave me his Aaron Pryor biography and asked me to sign it for him, and I gave it to Pryor, and Pryor was like, "Hey, man," when he signed it, I'll never forget this too. He looked, he said, "Hey, thank you for reading my book. I hope you learned something from it. I hope you got something out of it." And he shook my hand. It wasn't even my book, but he just like was like touched that someone read his book, you know?
That's awesome.
Pryor was that dude. He got married at the Hall of Fame, bro. I was there. Lee Groves awesome. Was there. A lot of people were there. Yeah. He got That's married awesome. During induction weekend on the stage, and everybody was there to watch it. And that was beautiful, man. I can say imagine as a little kid reading about Aaron Pryor for the first time and like reading about his fights and all that, and then one day being somehow at his wedding.
Yeah, that's pretty wild shit, dude.
Yeah.
At Aaron Pryor's wedding. Yeah. Cool. I mean, he, needless to say, he didn't get a whole lot of rest in life. So hopefully he's resting well now.
He deserves it.
He'll definitely be missed.
But what do you got, my friend?
So I was actually going to go a little bit more recent, I guess, just because I had the good fortune of being at the third fight, and it was one of the few series as far as kind of like fight of the year and big fight series where they got progressively better somehow. Okay. I mean, just how, I don't know. But the first Rafael Marquez versus Israel Vasquez fight was great. It was a really fun fight. You know, if I remember correctly, it was like in the fifth or sixth round, Marquez busted Vasquez's nose and it was just like in absolute shambles. And on top of that, Vasquez he had awful scar tissue around his eyes already. He already had a propensity for cutting, et cetera, et cetera. He was in bad shape, wound up having to get stopped in the corner, I think it was. And then, you know, Marquez came out of that
fight. He had one of those Genaro Hernandez against Oscar De La Hoya nose shatters.
It was just, just
bad,
brutal. And so then they come back, though, and wage a rematch. And it looks at first like Marquez is going to repeat. And then Israel Vasquez is like, nah, I don't think so. Not today, buddy. And they go to war. And it's an absolute fucking all-out battle for, you know, a number of rounds until Rafa Marquez gets stopped. And then the third fight winds up just being an absolute fucking slugfest for the ages, bro.
Dude, that fight was incredible.
I almost got my ass kicked at that fight because I was there live telling people, like, how are you not standing up for this? Because these people were like...
Let me ask you a question. Wait up. So people were sitting down during that third fight, which is one of the best fights of that day.
It was,
and
like,
then you challenged, and then you calling them out for sitting down made them stand up and want
but
to
I
fight.
Wasn't even being like rude. I think I was just being like annoying more than anything. But it was like the 11th round or something.
But that's what got them hyped to fight.
I was like, what the fuck are you guys doing sitting down, bro? Like, this is hilarious. Nuts. Like, how are you guys sitting right now? And they were like turning around looking at me like they were gonna. I was like, I'm just saying, this is awesome, bro. Like, be my friend in boxing, help. No, it was crazy, dude. The just being able to be there for that was incredible. All three fights were really good. I don't know how they could have progressively gotten better. And I mean, well, I should
say that's very rare. That's one of the that's so rare.
I know, we're not even counting the fourth fight. That just doesn't even count, dude. Like, don't even get it out of here.
You both did the hand move at the same time, exactly.
Yeah, just get it. No, but it's just an absolute incredible three fight series, and how they could have gotten better from that first fight, which was already really good. It was just, it almost makes me excited and sad at the same time, because they gave everything in those fights and totally ruined themselves and just did not get compensated what they should have. I mean, and I know that's on like a whole series of people and everything, but damn.
And if you see like Rafa Marquez today and you know his eye issues and everything, it's just, it hits you.
And you know, not, and again, this is not talking shit. This is me lamenting it. I saw a recent photo of Izzy Vasquez.
Yeah. I said Rafa Marquez. I meant Izzy Vasquez. That's what I meant.
Yeah, Rafa Marquez has a lot of scar tissue.
No, no, too, he's totally he seems fine. Okay. No, I meant
Izzy, he seems okay overall.
That's the wrong name. Izzy Vasquez, that's what I meant. All but of man, his eye issues and everything. Yeah.
He looks awful. Like, I mean, he looks good health-wise.
No, he's good, but just like his eye issues.
But his face doesn't even look like him.
He should have never fought that last fight against Marquez. But dude, look at the amount of wars he provided for us. He first came on the scene. I think
Johnny Gonzalez almost got him. He came so close.
Dude, his first fight, I remember watching him, was the rematch with Oscar Larios, which I think he lost, which was on ESPN2 on Friday Night Fights. And that was an incredible fight in itself. But he ended up coming back in the third fight and he's blasting Larios out. But like you mentioned too, man, his other fights to that. The Johnny Gonzalez fight, which no one really brings up today because there was a lot of good fights there in that era, and it kind of, you know, as fights tend to do, it kind of got lost in the shuffle. But that fight is incredible, man. Johnny Gonzalez was moving up in weight, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, he went from 118 to 122.
Yes, and he was showing, it was on a pay-per-view on a card. I don't know what the main event was, but
I'd have to look, but
that fight sold the show. Like, Johnny Gonzalez dominated early. Dropped him a couple of times. Like, Izzy Vasquez was a warrior, bro. Came back and stopped him. That was an awesome fight.
You had to take him out of commission because he was the zombiest. Like, you had to take him out.
Totally, totally, man. It was that was a great fight. It's a classic, classic, you know, alluding to Lee Groves' book. But like that's what that was, man. A very, very good fight. And then the Larios fights, and then you bring it up to the fights that he had with Rafael Marquez. You know, Marquez was a wrecking ball during that time. You know what I mean? He was there in the he stopped Tim Austin's reign, who was a long reigning bantamweight champion. And then the way he was just bludgeoning through everybody else until he fought Vasquez. And like you said, he broke Vasquez's nose, everything. Then that rematch. But dude, that, you know, the rematch, Vasquez came back, goes back and forth. You know, Vasquez ends up stopping him. That third fight, though, I watched it here. I had nothing to my name at that point. I had just moved to New York. Was going through a lot of stuff at that point. And like, you know, everybody is kind of struggling. I still paying for cable at that point, a little bit. And I had enough that I was able to pay for that fight. And I watched that. And I just, like, my mind was blown. I'm sure everybody else was watching it. That last round, like, you can't beat that shit, bro. That was, like, that culminated everything. The fact that a fourth fight happened that you and I both said doesn't count because of how good that fight was in that third fight.
Yeah, well, and I think also to finally get him paid right, too.
Yes.
And I mean, I won't go into it. I'll just simply say that I was escorted out of the post-fight press conference for the third fight for yelling.
Was it because of a person? Was it because of a promoter that likes to wear sweatsuits?
I yelled at Gary Shaw.
That's him.
I screamed at Gary Shaw. I asked a very insulting question, which I knew was insulting, and asked it specifically to be insulting, like a real asshole, because I was pissed. I was pissed for the exact same reasons that I was sad a moment ago, because I could see what was happening and I could see that these fighters, I felt they deserved a lot more. I felt that it should have been much bigger than it was. Mm-hmm. I felt like the promotion was really lacking, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into the whole big story. Point is, I wound up getting escorted out of the press conference and to some degree making an ass out of myself, but for good, at least in my head at the time, intentions. And so I remember it very vividly for a number of reasons, that being one of them. But, and so that fourth fight was largely to get him paid right. I remember that was one of the big, like, promotional things for that fourth fight was they're finally getting paid $1 million. And I just remember slapping my fucking head and just going like, so they had to kill each other three times. And now this guy is going to have to go get his face punched off to go. Come on, you guys. So that's what I was kind of just like, I hated that shit. But the fights themselves and what they gave, you know, timeless shit, dude. Absolutely unforgettable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And good reference for that one. Like, because it was so, like, I mean, it was years ago, but, like, I have a lot of memories of that, too, in terms of, like, where I was living out here and all this other stuff. Yeah, dude, you can't beat that. That third fight. And, again, that was, like, another, like, Oscar Award winner, like, the last round, like, Chacon, Lamont IV, the way he, like, Vasquez kind of and caught him in the ropes and everything. Dude. Vasquez was awesome, man. It was such good shit.
Yeah.
Really great. Cool. I met Vasquez. I met Marquez with his trainer at the time, Daniel Zaragoza. And that was really cool at the Hall of Fame. I've always loved Zaragoza since I was a kid watching him and all that. So, yeah.
Hell yeah. We've talked about it before. Fighters who do it and get it done with little power.
Yeah, man.
Thumbs up from me.
Thumbs up from both of them. Yes, sir. Here's one for you. A fight where the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world was actually struggling before he got disqualified in a fight that everyone was just like, holy shit, he looks human.
And then brought out RJ.
Yes. And so because of that, they had to have a rematch for that. And everyone was really, really, really curious to see. And they even had a Ring Magazine article where they thought that that person would, like, give that guy all hell in the world, all that. We're talking about Roy Jones, Montel Griffin. And we're not talking fight of the years over here, nothing like that. But, like, you know what? If you watch that fight live on HBO, the first fight, Montel Griffin gave Roy Jones absolute fits. And the way he won it and everything happened about that, they had to have a rematch. And, of course, it was going to be on pay-per-view.
You know, Eddie Futch was in there training Montel Griffin. Eddie Futch, one of the all-time great trainers. Yes. Absolutely.
In my opinion, that probably was his last great performance.
gosh, he died in 2001.
Well, I mean, well, he was also in the corner of Johnny Tapia when Tapia beat Romero, but there were so many cooks in the corner he was kind of like, you know, an afterthought in that, right? But his last one where his whole knowledge, his whole worth, when you really saw what happened, was in that fight with Roy Jones.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, because he only died a couple of years after that.
A few years after that. But like, you know, Eddie Futch, man, those old trainers, bro, I love them so much. Him, you know, Freddie Brown, Ray Arcel, I'm missing so many. There's so many you can mention, like Gil Clancy, Milko
Dundee, all those guys, yeah.
All those guys, bro, man, Whitey Bimstein, like the old school trainers. And, you know, Eddie Futch, a person who always took care of himself and was just like, you know, an OG that put himself there. He had a great game plan. And it was kind of similar to the one that he implied with Ken Norton against Muhammad Ali. Little tweaks here and there, but some more, you know, more similar than not. And it worked like a charm against Roy Jones. And it was
pissed him off enough to disqualify him.
Totally. But we had to have a rematch for that. And you know what happened? Montel Griffin made some of the most bonehead decisions in boxing history.
That I remember actually watching that first fight, and I remember thinking very similar to like the Eric Harding fight, that it was just a guy whose style, that counterpunching style, like Roy didn't like it. Roy, you know, it's obviously easy to say in hindsight, but in hindsight, I think there were two things that Roy either didn't like or that kind of undid him. One was punchers, obviously, but that for the most part, he either didn't let the punchers that he fight get going. So he destroyed them before they even got going. Yes. And so he never had to face it, or he didn't fight them because there were a handful of punchers that he just never fought. And I mean, no fault. We ain't getting into that. I'm just saying. But, you know, and then the other thing was that when fighters made him lead, you know, a counter puncher, like by, you know, fighting another counter puncher who's making them do the leading. A lot of fighters don't like that shit. And that's something that we've actually seen from Tank Davis a handful of times, where he doesn't really seem to like being made to, you know, made to make the fight. And that's fairly common for a lot of counter punchers. And so we saw Montel Griffin doing that shit where he's, you know, changing stances or doing that really weird kind of crab walk, like footwork, like Norton used to do, doing the kind of the shell covering up shit like that, that makes it really tough to find a hole in their defense. If you're like a real precision puncher or use your hand speed, like a Muhammad Ali or like a Roy Jones. And so Roy Jones having serious trouble, you know, finding flush punches on Montel Griffin, and he's getting punched back, but it's like those little, like, you know, pop, 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 you know, punches that they're not hurting him whatsoever, but just pissing him off.
And so it was also tough. Yeah, man. The way he came at him. So Futch had a similar, like I said, it was a similar style that he implied with Norton Ali, but with some tweaks. And if I remember correctly, Futch said that, like, he had, even though Griffin was short, like you just alluded to, like you just mentioned, he still had him jabbing out of a semi-crouch, like he had Jones. No one really jabbed Roy Jones, so he backed him up. Jones gets to the ropes. Unlike Ali, who used to lean back and try to, like, do things like that, Jones would stand straight up. You've seen that. We've all seen this. Jones stands straight up at the ropes. And so Butch told him, you know, when he does that, like he kind of said with Norton, jab at his body at that point. Start working on his body. Jones drops his hands there. Then that's when you come up and you start working on him. And that's how you get him on the ropes, because he's still going to be straight up. He's going to try to do that type of stuff and try to counter offer it. But he's not really using, like, leaning back or using head movement. And that's what – and it worked like a charm. You know, he jabbed with Jones, who many people didn't try to jab with Jones. And it was a brilliant strategy. And
Roy is so dependent on, like, that rhythm. You know what I mean? Like, you get him out of that rhythm, and he just doesn't seem to do as well.
And he was out of that rhythm, man. Futch had it, like, down. And – like, not to say that it was like a, you know, Jones was getting routed or nothing. Like, it was still a close fight. Like, Jones was Superman. Like, his reflexes and everything he did was still make anything whatever. But, like, Griffin was giving him more problems than any of us had ever seen at that point. James Toney didn't give him these problems. Any of the other, you know, Bernard Hopkins in their first fight didn't give him these problems. Anyone else that he had fight in between this up until the heavyweight, no one had given these problems. You know, an old Mike McCallum, no one had... we had never seen Roy Jones under duress at this point. And Montel Griffin was making him, like, you know, think, was making him struggle a little bit. And here's the thing, man. Like, it was getting a little bit closer. It looked like that Roy was finally figuring him out, but he was still struggling. It was like, you know, a relatively close fight that Roy looked like he was pulling ahead, but he was annoyed with it. And when he finally dropped Griffin, that's when, you know, he caught him with that right hand. And people think that Griffin might have been spotting, you know, might have been like acting a little bit. Nah. If you watch closely, Roy threw like a full-on effect, just a few inches, and hit him straight on. Did Griffin might have made a face? Yeah, that face looked a little bit exaggerated, but like he got straight up walloped.
Yeah, he well, and on top of that, it was two. Like he went pop, pop. Like in the first one was like the first one was almost like a little jab, but then he just went bink. I mean, I think that Montel Griffin probably played it up.
No, he did a little bit, yeah.
But that it hit him, and that it, well, whatever. It doesn't really matter that much.
That's what it led to the rematch. Everyone was just like, man, you know, like I said, Steve Farhood, the great Steve Farhood, wrote an article, and I agreed with it back then, and I think everyone else did, that like Montel would probably give Roy every time they, you know, issues every time they
fought. A lot of people thought that. They just thought that it was like, you know, Montel might have his number.
But You know, they make the rematch. It's going to be held in Foxwoods, I think, in Uncasville, or Mohegan Sun, one of those casinos out there in Connecticut. And people are really excited. Like, this is a big rematch. So what happened, my friend? RJ came out.
That's one of the most hilarious things, dude, is that Roy was, like, leading up to, in the whole promotion, like, leading up to leading up to the rematch. Roy was just like, you know, I don't even care. Like, I don't even want to talk about it. I don't have anything to say. I'm just going to say that, you know, yeah, fuck him. You know, I'm going to fuck him up, you know, stuff like that. And that he kept saying that, like, you know, he's just going to see, you know, he's going to have to see, he's going to bring out RJ. And that, you know, before you saw Roy Jones, now I'm going to have to bring out RJ. And people are like, you know, who is this guy? This guy's a fucking, he also used to talk in the third person, like, you know, like any eccentric athlete apparently has to do, like, you know, y'all ain't even seen Roy Jonesy, you know, stuff like that. And so Montel Griffith, man, you should have just kept your mouth shut and tried to, like, you should just kept your mouth shut and tried to, I guess, box him again.
Not like fired Eddie Fletch and other, you know, your other people.
Basically made the bonehead, like, have this success and then switch corners move that fighters occasionally do. Man, I don't know if that would have made any difference. Says who knows if it was just Roy Jones honestly being pissed off enough to say fuck it and not really care, because Montel Griffin wasn't gonna knock him out, wasn't gonna do anything like that. So maybe he just said fuck it and said, you know, I'm knocking this cat out. You know, why box him? Who knows if it was actually hijack in his corner? Who knows? But Roy Jones caught him with that kind of like leaping hook slash uppercut and caught him to the point where Griffin's head just went straight back like that. And I just, for whatever reason, what sticks in my head is the little leg flip. Like, his legs went and he keeps trying to get up and his foot is malfunctioning. You know, man. Yeah, he got destroyed.
He also had, if you remember the first knockdown he caught, he had that Curtis Stevens face that happened years later, where like if Twitter was around back then, that would have been a meme too, where he got hit with that first left hook and he was like,
yeah, he goes, oh damn, or something like that.
Yeah, you could just see he was just like, what the hell just hit me? And yeah, that was RJ.
Well, you know what's funny is that, believe it or not, I think it was at 170 pounds, whatever light heavyweight was in the amateurs in the early 90s. I don't remember, but at light heavyweight, Montel Griffin beat a whole bunch of fighters in the amateurs. John Ruiz, he beat John Ruiz, I think, a few times. He beat Jeremy Williams. He beat Terry McGroom. Remember that guy?
Yeah, of course.
He beat a whole bunch of very recognizable fighters who went on to become heavyweights and shit like that. He was a tricky dude.
No, he was a really good fighter, man. If you watch back on the 20 fights where both our, the consensus was back then, they were really, really controversial. Think about this. Montel Griffin had less than 20 fights before when he fought James Toney the first time. And he beat him. You know, like, that was really, really impressive. Like, Toney was just coming off the Roy Jones fight. And that was like, Griffin was like his, you know. Griffin being an Olympian and all that, like, dude, he was a very good fighter, man. You know, he lasted a little bit longer than probably he should have, and, you know, being his size and everything like that, but, like, he was a very tricky fighter, very good fighter.
Yeah, he was not an easy guy to fight, not an easy guy to look good against. Kind of almost like a more skilled, like, John Brown, you know?
Yeah. And like, he had Eddie Futch in his corner. He had the venerable Fel Torrance in his corner. Like, you know, he had a lot of very, very veteran trainers out there, like, that give him the best advice to what he had to do. Yeah, I respect the shit out of him.
Yeah, a serious pain in the ass. So,
with that Dwight Howie hype, absolutely. So, what's next, my friend?
All right, dude. So I'm actually going to go back a number of years and just kind of, I guess, talking about both fight of the year, but also a case where the rematch definitely did not live up to the first fight whatsoever. We're talking about the night that Rocky Marciano won the heavyweight title against Jersey Joe Walcott, and then the follow-up to that. So, I mean, Rocky Marciano was pretty easy to... it's pretty easy to see why, with his fighting style, he would be in a fight of the year caliber fight. A guy who's like 5'8", 5'9", built like a brick shit house, and just throws almost nothing but haymakers, and obviously a very heavy puncher. It makes for good TV, makes for a good fan experience. Watching to see him slump some fools is pretty rough. So you could see,
hey man, it's from Massachusetts, bro. There's some people out there still that you can't talk bad about The Rock, they'll still try to punch you.
Totally, dude. Either Marciano or Hagler, even though Hagler is not technically from, it's just like, you can't.
Now Hagler's one of us. Yeah, we take Hagler as
he's been adopted.
He's been adopted years ago, way before I was born. Yeah.
Just how Jose Napoles was adopted by Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Hagler's one of us. New Englander. Totally.
Hagler was adopted by Mass, for sure. But, you know, you could see why Rocky Marciano would be exciting, why he's, you know, an easy fighter to watch and all that type of stuff. But he was obviously vulnerable, too. And we saw that, they saw that, against Jersey Joe Walcott for the first chunk of that fight. And they'd already seen it before, too, with Rocky Marciano struggling against a number of fighters. Mm-hmm.
Tiger Ted Lowry, who went the distance with twice.
So many people were suspected that he would be vulnerable against fighters.
Was crude. Marciano was a very, very, very crude fighter. Who the venerable Charlie Goldman, who was a longtime fighter himself and a great trainer, around the same era as Ray Arcel and Freddie Brown and Whitey Bimstein and all those other trainers from that era, like, you know.
Trained Marty Servo. Yeah,
all those guys.
Lou Ambers. Yeah.
So like he had a lot, you know, he the way he transformed Marciano into being an absolute just brute, into like giving him some sort of footwork and like incorporating a style into him, but not like completely transitioning him into the, you know, into like an out and out anything, like keeping elements of what he was as a crude brawler, but just like adding layers to him, was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And Marciano, just, you know, to himself being extremely tough, durable, hard punch, everything, just winning combination.
Offensively, he is probably underrated, just because, in my opinion, And I know that, you know, that's going to get pushback from people if they're trying to talk about skill in boxing and stuff like that. But like a Maidana type of guy, some people see that and they're going like, you know, there's no skill in that. I see that and I see a lot of skill, actually.
No, Marciano was very skilled.
Yeah, absolutely. Inside, he knew exactly what he was doing. Defensively, he clearly was not that skilled. He was not very interested in picking up a lot of new things or whatever like that. It didn't seem like it anyway.
But he was crafty in his own way. Like, he is sure he got hit.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
He
was not unskilled. It was just not in the classical sense.
Totally. Totally.
And so he looked vulnerable. He looked as though somebody could do X, Y, or Z with him. And Jersey Joe Walcott was the exact kind of fighter that you would think could, because that was what he was all about. He was very skilled. And when he wanted, he could pull out a nasty punch, just like in that absolutely picture perfect hooker cut knockout that he knocked out Ezra Charles with, which was just beautiful. Did that walk away and then the boop. that was Jersey Joe Walcott. And he showed it against Rocky Marciano in the first maybe 7 or 8 rounds of that fight, where he was walking Marciano around the ring. Man.
Dude, like, Walcott's a beautiful thing to watch. Like, I love when people make, like, videos of various clips of him, and they put, like, some cool-ass, like, jazz music or something to it, because he matches so well with it. The way he would, like, shift his body, do the little shimmy.
He didn't do, like, the regular footwork sometimes, but he'd just do this little, like, walk thing. And it was like, exactly. What the fuck are you doing?
Exactly, you know? And, sorry, I'm just trying to bring up an article over here, which I'm going to allude to in a second. But, the way he would...
Such a fucking boxing nerd that it's like you could just bring up a random fighter and you just grab a magazine from the table and go, yeah, I was just reading about him right here, actually.
Literally, I have a book literally right next to me to bring this up. It's insane. Yeah. How bad is that?
Yeah, this was not planned. This was not planned at all.
No. It literally wasn't. You brought this up and I had this book right next to me and I'm trying to bring it up now. Okay, yeah. So when you brought up the rematch, like Marciano Walcott, it ended in 13 rounds. But like Walcott, even though he was past it, like he was older and everything, like he put on a clinic in that fight. You know, he dropped Marciano early. He beat the shit out of Marciano most of the fight. But Marciano being an unhuman and being able to, like, you know, take monster, like massive punches the way he was you know, he just was able to take that shit, right? So like. That last round knockout, like that's one of the most famous punches in boxing history, where you see Walcott's face looking like a fighter from the 1800s, how they like illustrated it with the mouth gape open and the tongue hanging out that, and you see Marciano hitting him like it's
he looks like the fucking scream mask, bro. It's awful. And it's just an absolutely brutal knockout, because it's like the perfect confluence of Rocky Marciano's fist and Jersey Joe Walcott moving into it because he thought he could counter him right at that time.
Exactly.
And just caught the wrong end of it, man. Oh, it's one of the most brutal knockouts in history.
So since we brought this up, and this is hilarious, I can show you this right here and then bring up a story. Freddie Pacheco's book. From years ago, the 12 greatest rounds of boxing, the untold stories. You know, whether you think Freddie Pacheco was a great commentator or not, as a kid, I really enjoyed him. As an adult, I've realized that
kind of annoying, yeah.
Yeah, but can't deny that he had tons and tons of stories and is a legend in the sport of boxing. Absolutely. You can't take that away from him. So one of the 12 greatest rounds of boxing in his untold stories is about the rematch between Jersey Joe Walcott and Rocky Marciano. And since I literally had this right next to me as you brought this up, and I didn't even know you did, I thought I should share this because it's awesome. So he's going to, you know, I'll just read it to you really quick. It's not really that long-winded, but a little bit. An untold story. The great fight called for a main match. He's talking about Marciano Walcott. Every boxing fan clamored for it, but none more desperately than I did. I had a huge personal stake in a Rocky Marciano-Jersey Joe Walcott rematch. I had enlisted in the Air Force after spending 8 years in college and earning a couple of degrees, including one in the profession of pharmacy. This, I thought, should entitle me to a commission. Instead, the Air Force handed me 2 stripes, denoting the rank of Airman, 2nd class. To get that commission, my only alternative was Officer Candidate School, which I qualified in the spring of 1953. The first 3 months of OCS was sheer hell. The object being to weed out the weaklings and other otherwise unfit. Part of the intense physical hardship and hazing that the cadets underwent was a rule prohibiting them from smoking, drinking anything but water, and eating only candy bars. None of that bothered me, since I did not smoke, drink Cokes, or like candy. We had a flight officer who was a sports nut. I quickly made a deal with him. If our unit won the championships in an upcoming OCS competition, he would allow us total privacy and lift the ban on smokes and drinks so that we can watch on television the May 15th, 1953 Marciano Walcott return match for the heavyweight title to be held in Chicago. I used this motivation to whip our teams into a kamikaze-like frenzy for the purpose of winning our championships. After all, I reason, Marcian and Walcott had fought 13 rounds in their first encounter. This time, they would probably go the full 15. Translating that long bout into minutes and adding the time for pre-fight and post-fight TV coverage meant that we could have at least an hour and a half to smoke, drink Cokes, and eat Hershey bars in an air-conditioned recreation room. After what we had been going through, no oasis in the Sahara ever seemed as inviting. We indeed won our championships. Cashing in on the deal I had struck, we were allowed to don our comfortable fatigues and slouch around the TV set, smoking, drinking cold Cokes, and munching on Hershey bars. Of the many millions of Americans who screamed in outrage when Jersey Joe Walcott pitched forward from a perfect right-hand punch after only 2 minutes and 25 seconds of the first round had expired, none yelled as loudly as the cadets of the Charlie Flight Class 53C. Right! Back in Class A, formation in front in 5 minutes and clean up this mess. Move it! Move it! Move it! Barked our flight officer. All of a sudden, the upperclassmen swarmed among us, like predators on their prey. Many in my class refused to talk to me for a month after the fight. I can't say I blame them. It was my introduction to the foolishness of trying to predict the outcome of boxing events. Who would guess that? Years later, I would make a handsome living doing exactly that.
Bro, how many of us have not experienced, we've gotten a bunch of friends together for some fight and we're like, bro, this is gonna some violence. This shit's gonna be so fucking good. And then it fucking comes up and it's the biggest bullshit and they're so pissed at you. And you're just like, bro, it's usually good, I swear.
Not at that level though, man. I can't imagine being in the army and convincing all of my people in my class to say, hey man, we're gonna have an hour to smoke and drink and do whatever the fuck we want during a fight. And it lasts only a minute.
Yeah, that would suck.
You know what? I'm shocked Freddy Pacheco was able to fucking commentate Showtime and NBC and every other network shows back in later on, become Ali's physician. Because if I was there during that thing, I would have made sure I would have taken his ass out.
Yeah, we beaten his ass with a sock.
I would have straight up beaten the like daylights out.
Yeah, put a fucking bar of soap and a pillow. Like,
you pushed me, everything I could have done, everything I've like, all this stuff. I finally get a break, and you tell me this break lasts a minute because of this.
Ah, do you know how much cocaine I could have done in an hour?
We're throwing hands right here. We're throwing hands. Absolutely.
Dude, you know. I actually remember, I can't remember what program it was on, but I think it was one of those old HBO shows. I'd have to look, but they did, a whole little analysis of this fight and the ending and stuff like that on one of those old programs, because it was considered controversial at the time, because they were like, you know, there's the first fight where Walcott is doing fairly well throughout much of the fight, and then starts to kind of fade and visibly gets tired and then just absolutely gets obliterated. But then in the first fight, which almost, you know, never really seems to get going and seems to be taking a similar trajectory as the first fight in that first round of the rematch. And then Marciano just blasts him with this kind of awkward, like right hand kind of shovel punch type thing. Mm-hmm. And catches Walcott just perfectly on the chin, and like it's like, you know, he's moving backwards, but it's just in a way so it's like just his jaw gets caught.
They both throw at the same time and Marciano just got there first. It was like a 6-inch punch that just obliterated Walcott's face,
and he flies back onto his back and his legs are up and shit. But then he gets up and it looks like he's okay. Like
I was actually referencing the first fight, but no, totally. I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah, like in the rematch, okay. Looks like he's okay. Like that, the punch lands perfect, but it looks like, okay, like he's going to get up from this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it looks like he's about to brace himself on the rope. And is when he goes to get up, it's like he stops and then he reaches 10 and it's like, and then he gets up and he's just like, what?
Yeah.
Totally. And it's like, oh, bro. No, you missed it. You know, like we've seen, dude, I remember Muhammad Abdullayev. Remember that fool? I don't know if you remember this. This is kind of a deep cut here. I'm sorry. But I remember against fucking Emmanuel Claudi.
Hey, that's much of a deep cut for me.
He got, for you, it's not. For the average. So he wound up getting knocked down. And I remember he's sitting there looking right at the ref, and the ref's going like 8.
Yes. Yeah.
9. Yeah. And he's going, and he's like looking right at him, and he counts to 10, and then he hops up, and then he's going, What? And I was remember thinking at the time, oh, bro, like, I don't know if this was a translation thing or what. I don't know if, like, you know, your brain gets fried. Like, I've been knocked silly a couple times. I can't.
Aaron Pryor kind of did that against Bobby Joe Young in his only
Yeah.
He got dropped with the right hand. He gets
it's
up,
happened a bunch of
back
times.
Down to his knee, crossed himself, and then, like, he let himself get counted out. But that's the thing. I don't know if fighters forget if you go back down on – if you get up and go back down on a knee, like –
I mean, dude, I've been knocked silly before, and I can I can honestly say that in that condition, if there was somebody going in my face, I'd be like, "What in the fuck are you doing?" Like, you know, like it's alarming. But I guess that's the whole point about being a pro fighter is that you're supposed to be conditioned to know what to do in that situation. But still, it was strange. And so Jersey Joe Walcott is like, you know, he hops up and he's like, where are we? I don't know what's going on. You know, why did you count me out? And then starts complaining that the count was quick and they did a post-fight interview and all the sorts of stuff. But then in the magazines and in the articles, people were talking about how it was controversial and that the count was quick. Other people were talking about how he had deliberately took the count. You know, like it was fixed, basically, type of thing. Yeah, totally. And on top of that, the associations with Rocky Marciano, regardless of how strong they may or may not have been to the mob, you know, the fact that he's an Italian American probably scared some people. And on top of that, the streets of Boston and around Boston were a kind of scary place when it came to mob and mafia shit around this time. Shout out to Don Stradley, who wrote a book specifically about this for Hamilcar. But in any case, yeah, dude, I think a lot of people were skeptical. But if you watch it, that punch landed perfect.
Selfie during that time. I'll just say that.
Scary shit. But and it's understandable that people would think that. But it was
I mean, like, it looked it, and especially if you know Walcott's background too, with his management that was known that was like mob tied as well. Like, it was a lot of
questions. It was a funky time.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, that's my offering, is that, you know, that rematch definitely did not live up to the first fight.
No, totally not. Well, another one too that like took a few years, a couple of years that it took too long to make. Chavez Taylor, you know,
that's a good one. Yep, that's a good one too.
And Chavez Taylor, we've talked about it. Everybody has listened to the show, and everybody that knows, like, it's one of the most heartbreaking fights in boxing history. Because, like, if you really think of it in that regard, like, Meldrick Taylor, he took so much punishment that, like, regardless of what anything, he would have ended up the way he did, his career did, because, like, you know. He was shocked by that fight, but he deserved that victory. There was 2 seconds left. Richard Steele should have probably seen that, right? You know, that light flashing above him. The way that, you know, it's a championship fight. That was the first time he got knocked down. All this other stuff. Like, he, there's a lot of circumstances, but, you know, by the time that rematch happened and everything that, like, went through with it, it didn't need to happen. It really, really didn't need to happen. And Taylor at that point was completely shot. You know what I mean? But he still made it competitive.
We talked about that not that long ago. I don't remember the show, but the Legendary Nights, it's such a vivid clip where they do the, like, you know, before the pre-fight and then the fast forward 10 years later interview. It's just like, oof.
Or if you watch Meldrick Taylor against Terry Norris and they interview both fighters before the fight and then you listen to both fighters today. And I love both of them immensely. Like, Terry Norris is one of my all-time favorite.
This is
fighters.
Not us, like, making fun whatsoever.
No. It's just sad to hear, you know what I mean?
Yeah, man. That's actually a really good call, too. The first fight, so tremendous as far as, like, that build and momentum that finally, you know, they're poetically, and when people write about fights and stuff like that, and they talk about like, the art and fights and things, often we get these kinds of fights and that kind of build up, and there's never a payoff. There's never like a big release, you know, like there's never is that 12th round knockdown or knockout. It's just goes to a decision, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that fight and the way that everything built up and like the tension, and where you're just sitting there biting your nails, like where you're like, can Meldrick Taylor get through? Like, can he just make it to the bell? Like, is he going to? And you could see Chavez coming on, chomping at the bit, just kind of saying, fuck this, and coming after him, and then finally catching up. And it's just like, holy shit. You know, there are few things better than that. And whether you're a Taylor fan or a Chavez fan, just that, like, release of fucking hormones is crazy. And so that first fight, you know, was so huge and so controversial. Even now, dude, like, you know, I talk about shit I post on the history page, but it's relevant because I feel it's a good gauge as far as fan reaction and shit like that. Every single time there's like a war in the comments and in the replies, there's like fucking people are going to get shot and stabbed. You know, I have to measure myself as far as how often I talk about it because people get heated. Even now, they don't agree. So,
I mean, they were the two best fighters in the world in 1990. All right, like 1A and 1B. You had them match up. You had them fight. Like, dude, and it was a brilliant fight. Taylor, for all of his flurries, and then you know you see Chavez coming back in his little ways, but Taylor was still ahead. And then a little bit after halfway point, you see Taylor's face all swollen, bloody, and you're just like, wait, what the fuck happened?
Yeah, how did this even? Yeah. He was doing all right. What happened?
Like, because there's like certain things, man. You see it, like Chavez would land, boom, 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 and like land a big right hand, and then Taylor immediately afterwards would like, and like it would get all the announcers, including Sugar Ray Leonard, just like all hyped up. You see him like throw a flurry to the body and just come back with a fucking hook in the right hand that would snap Chavez's head completely back. And everyone's like, oh my God, those were beautiful flurries. And they were beautiful flurries. But Taylor fought too much like a Philadelphia fighter in that fight. You know, if you listen to the commentary of George Benton, not so much Lou Duva, who I respect, but like was more of a hype man in that team. You listen to George Benton.
Yeah, you could always count on Lou Duva to throw down in a fight if the referee was fucking up.
Oh, totally. And like, you know, Lou would like always like get you really, really excited and hyped up and all that. But George Benton was the one that gave you the instructions. And George Benton told Taylor over and over, he's pushing you too fast. He's pushing you. He's pushing you too fast. You need to settle down. Settle down. Relax. Settle down. He's pushing you too hard. Because it was the pressure that Chavez was putting on him was making Taylor just throw these fucking 10, 12, 15 punch flurries. And he was faster than Chavez. He was quicker to the trigger than Chavez. And like, you know, he was landing and you saw this fight. He's clearly winning. But like Chavez is pushing him. And, you know, Benting being a former fighter and knowing what's going on, he's telling him, hey man, he's pushing this pressure too hard on you. You need like settle down. Stop trying to like, you know what I mean? Like compensate for this. Like you need to settle down and box. And he couldn't. And you saw like slowly Taylor started just breaking down before the inevitable end.
Yeah, dude. You know, it's like you said, the way that Taylor goes from just, you know, looking pretty good and looking okay to all of a sudden just not looking okay is pretty amazing. And the way that unfolds is it's a fight with a lot of replay value. Absolutely no question. And because of that controversial ending, like we were talking about, I think that that's one of the big, big reasons. Like there's so many explanations and excuses and stuff like that when people talk about that fight and they're talking about why that fight ended the way that it did, and whether or not that fight was okay ending the way that it did and stuff like that. And like I said, people are still split now. They can't come to any consensus. I think that if I had to kind of, you know, take a vote or something like that, people more often than not would probably say that Taylor kind of got screwed in that fight, or at the very least, they felt bad for him. As far as the rest, I mean, it's really split down the middle. So of course they had to do a rematch. You can't have that, an ending like that in a fight, and in a fight that magnitude and on fighters on that level.
It just took a while for it to happen, man. And by that time,
yeah, and just Taylor was already
cooked. You know, like he fought Aaron Davis immediately afterwards. He won the welterweight championship. But like you could see like the signs of like regression on him already. You know, and by the time he was knocked up out of Cristiano España, that was it. And
yeah,
I was a novice fan when I watched it live when he fought Chavez in the rematch. But he still put up a very competitive fight. You know what I mean?
You could see flashes of, you know, you of the you first could. Fight. Yeah.
And the fight was still like 2 or 3 points, you know, all together, like with it. But like, he just, you know, it just never, yeah.
nah, he couldn't get that momentum going like he had in the first fight. And so that was pretty tough.
It was just like, you know, man, it was like, you know, Chavez just writing a wrong and putting a name on his ledger. And it's too sad because Taylor,
you can't take a beating like that in a vacuum, you know, and like it adds up.
If everything really happened right in the first fight, Taylor would have won that decision. First of all, he got up. And if you look ever so closely, I mean, it's really hard to decipher, but if you look ever so closely when Steele talks to him, you see it ever so slightly. You see him nod his head saying yes. It is, you got to pay attention, but you do see it. Like, yes, he's paying attention. And this was, you know, the cornerman's fault on their part for doing this, for getting his attention. Like, he's watching them. But when Steele says, you okay, ever so slightly, you see Taylor go slightly nod his head. And as a championship fight, it's a unification fight. You should just let it go on. And if he turned around and saw Chavez literally right behind him, he would have done something like in the fucking Lombardo Andrade fight against Lucien Boutte.
Yeah,
get back. Marlon, be right. Get back. Because Chavez was breaking the rules.
At least he should have. Yeah.
Because Chavez was literally right behind Steele at that point, ready to pounce. You know, like kind of Dempsey against Tony almost. You know, like,
yeah, dude. I mean, the debate could literally rage on forever. You know,
we're coming up close. It's 32 years next year, we'll make 33 years. Like, yeah, so
yeah, the debate rages on, it's never settled, that's for sure. You know, and well, I guess there's not really too much debate about it anymore, and they seem to be kind of friends, but frenemies, on and off friends. But the next one I was going to talk about. Was, I mean, easy one to talk about. And on top of that, two fights between them, one fight of the year, going back to the fight of the year, just because it's easy. And there aren't that many cases of that happening. There's only a handful. Because for this specific reason that we're talking about on the show, usually the rematch does not live up to the hype of the first fight or doesn't quite live up to the first fight. And that is Eric Morales and Marco Antonio.
Good Barrera. One. I was going to bring that up too.
Awesome. Okay. Well, sorry, I stole it from.
No. You didn't steal anything. I'm glad we just bring it up in general. Yeah.
You know, for a long ass time, I've looked for the specific instances that started this. Like, you know, it might just be that I've looked in the wrong place, but I know for years, people have said more or less what started their feud and what the comments were. Supposedly, Marco Antonio Barrera made the comments to some paper or magazine or something that Eric Morales was just an ignorant Indian, which is obviously now and then very derogatory and classist and awful. And I'm not saying that what Morales responded with was equal, but that he responded something to the effect of that Barrera, I think he actually might've responded a homophobic slur, but that he basically responded to the effect of, look, Barrera's family is, if I'm not mistaken, his family makes movie sets in Mexico City. And so they're not-
I know, like, Barrera's more well-off than Morales, yeah.
Yeah, so they're not like wealthy, but he comes from like a fairly, you know, like middle class family or whatever. Totally. And that is a source of tension, you know, not only in Mexico, but all over the fucking world. And so supposedly that's where everything started. And then leading up into their first fight, you know, it made sense. Like it made sense, I guess, that they would be kind of at each other as far as like the landscape of the division. But also, this was like, again, everybody thought that Marco Antonio Barrera was done. You know, like he had like several career resurgences and shit. And they thought that he was basically done, you know, Junior Jones, a big debacle, etc. Yeah, yeah. And then he goes in with with Eric Morales, who is this up and coming destroyer. And a lot of people felt like this was a bad opponent for Barrera and the bad time for him. And I mean, luckily they locked horns and it wound up being just perfect.
Dude, that first fight was incredible, man. Like, a lot of people, like you just alluded to, like a lot of people thought after the Junior Jones fights, everything, that like Barrera was kind of, you know, that might have been it. like he had reached his ceiling, like we mentioned with Kambosos. We talked about with Kambosos on before. It didn't happen to be the case, man. You know, Morales was riding really high at that point. He had knocked out Junior Jones. He knocked out more. He finished the career of Daniel Zaragoza. Like, he was looked upon as being close to the man of that division. Was Wayne McCullough before him or after?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I think before.
I think it might have been a fight before.
It was before, yeah. Yeah, it was. And so, you know, Morales had, like, established himself. Like you mentioned, Barrera, he got based. Forget about the DQ. He got stopped by Junior Jones. Junior Jones stopped him. You know, bludgeoned him with right hands, and that was stopped. The rematch, Barrera performed better, but still, you know, lost a close decision. So yeah, you know, by the time 2000 comes around, and Morales, who was young when he first won the WBO title, and was still like growing and developing as he stopped Daniel Zaragoza, make his subsequent defenses up until the zenith now against, you know, Barrera, he was looked upon. He still hadn't reached his prime, but he was like really, really close to him. He's on the upswing and won the pound, you know, looked upon as a pound for pound great. Barrera, the consensus, most people are looking at him. He wasn't washed, but they thought that Morales would have been, you know, a guy that just would have beat him to keep on solidifying where he was at. You know, Barrera had already, you know, the two losses that he lost to Junior Jones.
Yeah, it looked like so, two guys going in different directions.
Totally. That's how I looked at it. That's how it was presented. That's how I even thought about it a little bit. And it totally wasn't one that, man. Like, the back and forth, both guys were hurt. They hurt each other. They cut each other. It was one of the best fights of the 2000s, if not the absolute best fight. If Corrales Castillo 1 didn't happen, that probably would have won the award for best fight of the 2000s.
It's so rare that you see fighters on that level doing that shit where they just go like this and just like both of them at the same time, just
dude,
you know, like, and it's like they just don't move their head, they don't give a fuck, and they're just like, I'm punching, you're punching, just fucking go. Like, dude, and like it doesn't happen that often.
Take each one of them shits, you know what I'm saying? Like, they could take their power. That was what's beautiful about it. Like, they hurt each other, but neither one like really went down. They were both marked up.
And yeah, they couldn't quite get the edge on the other. Like, it was just like, it was yeah, so man.
Every time Morales looked like he was starting to like roll, Barrera would come right back. And anytime Barrera looked like he was rolling, Morales would fight back. At the end of the fight, I thought Barrera slightly edged it by the slimmest of margin.
I think a lot of people felt like that, yeah.
Yeah. When Morales won, you know, I wasn't mad, but I was like, you know, I thought Barrera won it. And the second fight, which happened in 2002, correct?
Yes.
That you know, kind of like Ward Gotti, that was like the slow one of the series.
Yeah, I actually quite enjoy that fight. I know a lot of people don't, especially compared to the first fight. Like, it's cool. I get it. You know, it's definitely not the barn burner the first fight was. And
no, and it was still a compelling fight. And you know, they had a lot of heat with each other, but compared to how the first fight was, and the flurries and the action and the hatred and the violence, this one was much, much more condensed, and that favored Morales.
And I thought that you know, the rematch, it was kind of just like, all right, well, Barrera had settled down a little bit and decided that he was going to box more in the rematch, especially because, like I said, he had already had this, like, after the first Morales fight, and especially because he lost, some people are like, all right, well, I guess that's last chance for his ass. You know, he's out now. And so then they put him in with Nassim Hamed, and people are just like, nah, Hamed, nah, dude, Hamed's going to whoop his fucking ass. I remember that shit. A lot of people were like, dude, Hamed's going to kill him. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I will make a point. The fight before that, even though he was washed, when he fought Jesus Salud, you got to admit, Barrera, like, that's when he first employed the boxing style, I thought. Like, the style that no one had really seen before, when he was really pumping the jab and everything else. And I was like, I thought that too. I was like, holy shit, he looked different than I had seen him.
Well, and even
I still thought he was going to whooped against Hamed.
I agree. Yeah. No, I agree. But even so, a lot of people were just like, yeah, I mean, Hamed's too, he's too hard. He's too good.
Totally. I thought Hamed was going to do it too. So
and it was like he had this another, you know, extra rebirth against Hamed, even though I will say, and I might catch flack for this, but I thought that fight on the cards was a lot closer than because people are like, oh, Barrera whooped his ass. And I'm kind of looking at it.
It's all about that last round. Remember when Barrera put him in the, you know, in the full Nelson.
The headlock shit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then grabbed him and slammed him into the ropes. And Jim Lampley made the comment, a la spelled Barrera or something ridiculous. Like,
Dude, especially with like, so much happened around that time.
We discussed this on our prior show. Hamed gets no love today for whatever reason.
And there were a lot of funky comments made right around that time that especially now years on watching it back and watching like the documentary about it is just like, you guys were talking about this guy in a really racist way, man. Like, and anyway, but the way that Barrera was able to just, he had the biggest moments of that fight. He won that fight. There's absolutely no question. And then, so after winning that, and then he had kind of continued that style into the Morales rematch, which I thought he won fairly clearly, but then that was controversial because people were like, nah, Morales made the fight. He pressed the fight. And so it was like, you know, they got to do it a third time.
I'm going to be honest, I have not watched it since 2002.
It's been a long time, but in any case, them splitting those first two fights and the way that they both look so different, obviously meant at some point they were going to have to fight a third time, and they still fucking hated each other. So, you know, making for a third fight, the second fight in terms of action did not live up to the first fight, but the third fight, on the other hand, it didn't quite live up to the first fight in terms of intensity, but was very, very good.
Well, it certainly surpassed the second fight. That's for damn sure.
No question. And even had the added bonus of Eric Morales' father throwing the water bottle at Barrera when he came to say, like, let's make up.
I mean, that's, you know, I'm glad those two seem to be like, I heard they had a falling out again, but like on Reddit or something.
Yeah,
like,
it's tough to know. I don't know.
I who knows, but man, but like, yeah, that's one of the rare occasions where like they really step up for that third fight and like both bring it to their full extent. But
yeah.
You know, I think Barrera solidified himself for winning that trilogy by, like, clearly winning that third fight.
I agree.
A lot of people thought that he won the first fight. Second fight is 50-50. I know a lot of people thought Morales might have edged it.
Yeah.
But that third fight, Barrera clearly won it. And it was the fight of the year. Like, it was an incredible fight, but Barrera just slightly got the better of it.
I agree, yeah. Well, yeah, so they had two fights of the year. And, I mean, which is in itself rare.
Totally, totally rare. You know, there's... not so much what, well, actually, you know, I'll bring one up for you. It just took years and years and years to have a rematch. Thomas Hearns and Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, in a fight that, and here's the thing that's interesting about that. We don't have to elaborate too much on it because I think we've discussed it before and most people have probably seen it, but that was a fight beforehand that most people thought was an afterthought and that Leonard was just trying to like, you know, just get another, rematch on his record where he can blow out the competition. And Hearns, to his credit, was able to, because of the motivation of the first fight and just dying for a rematch and still, you know, not being as washed as everybody believed, was able to produce one of the best fights of the 80s. And not only that, he got clearly robbed in that fight.
I'm a huge Tommy Hearns fan. It's my favorite fighter.
Yeah.
Even so, that first fight is, if not my favorite fight, you know, just one of my favorite.
It's an incredible fight, man. Like, you're not going to get the type of action that you're thinking when people say it's one of the best fights of all time. And then the average boxing fan is going to think, oh, it has to be like Ward Gotti, war to war, you know, Ali Frazier type deal. It wasn't like that. There was like four different fucking stories to this fight, chapters, everything you want to say, man. It was beautiful.
Yeah, the corner work is great. There, it has like epic, you know, it has some epic quotes, you know, you're blowing it, kid. It's got some great commentating, the moments in the fights, there's back and forth. It's at a high skill level.
It's the way they had to change their styles completely too, you know?
And it was like at the perfect time in their respective careers. You know, Ray Leonard had already redeemed himself against Roberto Duran. Tommy Hearns was coming up and seemed just like an absolute wrecking machine. And these styles got together and mixed just perfectly, absolutely perfectly. And the way that, you know, like you said, having to switch styles and kind of adjust throughout the fight, Ray Leonard comes in and is definitely the boxer puncher type of guy, but winds up coming in as a little bit more of a puncher. But then Tommy Hearns starts trying to go after him a little bit, and Ray Leonard's like, fuck that, disengages. But then Tommy Hearns is like building up a couple points, and Ray realizes he's got to go after him. And then they kind of switch a couple times even from there. And it's just like, on that level, it's tough to beat, dude. It's really tough to beat
that fight. It's an incredible fight, man. I mean, the fight happened in 81. We're talking 41 years ago now, close enough. So that fight happened in September. So we're talking almost 41 years ago now. And it still holds up as like all the fights everybody like, you know, want to compare it to. Is it Leonard Hearns? Is it Leonard Hearns? You know, with that being said, the rematch almost gets overshadowed to a degree. You don't hear many people talking about it as much.
It was a good fight.
It was a hell of a good fight. You know, like,
even Leonard today, really, Tommy's still pissed.
As he should be. That's the one fight Sugar Ray Leonard will admit that he lost. You know,
which is really saying something.
Yeah. Besides the Terry Norris and Camacho fights, that's the one fight Sugar Ray Leonard will say, yeah, I lost that fight. And
yeah, he didn't lose that fight, really saying something, too. No, totally. He's got a hell of an ego about that shit.
Like, not to say it was a blowout. Leonard had a lot of moments, and he came close to stopping Hearns at the end of the fight. But Hearns dropped him twice. And outboxed him for the majority of it. It is what it is. But it was a really compelling fight and a tough fight for Hearns. You know, obviously still feeling a lot of salty from 81, just compelled himself to really bring it. You know, a lot of those guys will do that, to bring themselves to another level. And
he had to kind of will himself through the end of the fight, too.
He did. He really did, because he was in deep shit at that point.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a good one. It's sad. Especially for me as a Hearns fan, but still though, it's part
Hearns
of what
deserved that win, man. And like people say, oh yeah, you know, the four kings, Hearns probably at the bottom. No, you listen. Name me one fighter that outboxed Tommy Hearns.
That's what I'm saying is that I know. Now you're gonna get me into fanboy mode, but I know people are talking about Tommy's right hand, and they should, because that's a hell of a right hand. Great left hook too, by the way, but. He was an incredible boxer, dude. He was a really, really incredible boxer.
Off his jab, right hand, those body shots that he would throw like a whip, everything, man. Tommy Hearns was incredible to watch.
Yeah, incredible boxer. Easily my favorite, dude. Actually, that's going to be about all we have time for, believe it or not. But, I mean, we jammed some good fights in there.
We definitely did. And there's other ones, too, that you could have brought up, man. There's a whole Zale and Graziano. Zale Graziano. First two fights, all-time greats. The third fight, a putt. We eluded the Ward Gotti. First fight was incredible. Second fight was kind of a dud. That wasn't a dud, but compared to the first and third fights, it was.
Yeah, totally.
You know, we mentioned in one of our recent podcasts the fights between Jeff Harding and Dennis Andres. And also, too, you want to go back a little bit, the long-awaited rematch between Joe Lewis and Billy Kahn that took way too many years and both guys were past it.
That's a good point. Yeah, well, and like the whole fight of the year thing gets funky because
it gets funky and all that, but I'm just talking about different rematches.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, and the whole concept of the fight of the year, you know, they came up with it in the 40s officially, but there were awards for fight of the year before that. But anyway.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, I appreciate you coming on to talk some more history with me, man. It's always a great fucking time, dude.
Oh, man, this was great, bro. We're always just rolling. And listen, if anyone, you know, for the Hall of Fame's coming up this weekend, if anyone's, you know, wants to, anyone, any listeners of the show or anything like that, I'm going to be out there. Unfortunately, Pat can't join me. But if you see me, I'm going to be the guy wearing a 40-year-old t-shirt and having a lot of tats. You can't miss me.
Yeah, dude, you should be pretty easy to see. You know,
you can't miss. I'm the one with the Sonny Liston tattoo, some other stuff around there, and I'll probably be wearing a Duran or Benitez shirt or something like that.
You're gonna be the one just absolutely flocked with knuckles and gloves fans. No question.
Hopefully so.
Hey, dude, I appreciate it. And everybody who listened in on the podcast, we appreciate you. If you wouldn't mind subscribing, also appreciated. Rate us, give us a comment. We love that stuff. If you watched on YouTube, also subscribe, comment, all that. You know, we love those things. We're on social media. Knuckles and Gloves is on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter too, but we're also individually on Twitter. My buddy Aris is on Twitter as Punch Zone Aris, me, Patrick Connor. I'm on there as Patrick M. Connor. interact. We'll talk to you soon, sure. Harris. I'll talk to you soon, bro.
All right, man. Enjoy, everybody.
Yeah, have fun at Hall of Fame, too, man.
Yes, sir.
Later, everybody.